The aim of Culturicos podcasts is to provide the listener with an artistic yet realistic mosaic of human pictures. Macroscopic events of our society result from a complex combination of individual dreams and ambitions. We provide stories that have humans as their core element, from macro stories about our multifarious culture, including politics, society, and science, to micro stories of individuals' hopes, struggles, and change. Our stories are told by people with their own life experiences, beliefs, and reflections of past and present events. We therefore provide a multifaceted image of our world, observed and understood from different perspectives.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Culturico podcast. I'm Pablo, and today we're going to have a deep discussion about the causes, treatments, and future prospects of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. To do so, I'm joined by two excellent guests and experts on the topic, Juliette Fouché and Tommy Bunte. Welcome to the show, Juliette.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And welcome to you too, Tommy.
Thank you, Pablo. Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure. I'm really very honored to have you here. Both of you are extremely knowledgeable about ALS and you fight on several fronts. So I'm sure that we are going to have a very complete overview of the current situation. For those listening, Juliette is a researcher at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. And there she's working on her PhD and as the clinical research coordinator at the Karolinska University Hospital. On top of that, she's also the Nordic patient liaison for TRICALS, a large European network working on finding a cure for ALS, and she's also the co-founder of the International Network for ALS Research and Care. Tommy is the manager of the ALS Clinical Trial Unit at the University Medical Center at Utrecht. He's also the physician assistant in the Division of Neurosciences in Neurology. He's also trainer for outcome measures for the TRICALS. And as Juliette, he's also a co-founder of the International Network for ALS Research and Care. We'll talk about this later, but before digging deep, I wanted to put the listeners up to speed on the topic by quickly introducing the disease to those less aware of it. ALS, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, is a neurodegenerative disorder that causes the loss of motor neurons controlling the voluntary muscles. This leads, among other symptoms, to muscular atrophy, and ultimately to the death of the patient by respiratory failure. ALS affects about 2 people per 100,000 in Europe, although it's a global disease. Those are the numbers for Europe. And it's also extremely aggressive, with a life expectancy of 2 to 5 years after the diagnosis. We will go into further detail throughout this podcast, but this sets more or less the base of the discussion that is going to follow. So let's start first with what you do and your interest in the research in ALS. So Juliette, what drew you to ALS and how is your day-to-day work?
So what drew me to ALS started when I started university as an undergrad. I've always been super interested by neuroscience, neurodegenerative diseases. I just found the mystery of them very appealing as a researcher, and it just sparked interest, all of this unknown around those diseases. And just being in Montreal for my master's brought me to knowing Dr. Angela Genge, who's working at the McGill Institute of Neurology. And she introduced me to ALS, clinical trials with ALS, and everything started from there.
Oh, wow, that's great. And that was, you say, how long ago?
Oh, well, 2017 I graduated, and then ALS just started to be part of my interest, and I joined that team at the time in Montreal.
Oh, so about 6 years then.
Yeah.
That's cool. And what about you, Tommy? What drew you to the disease?
Yeah, so initially I started just working at the neurology ward. That was back in 2009 here in the hospital. And then I continued studying health sciences. And after finishing up that study, I saw myself more working on a on policy in the hospital. But then I got connected with Professor Vandenberg, or Leonard Vandenberg, one of the key opinion leaders in the field back in 2015. And I thought initially just to start off working in clinical trials, to do that just 6 months to a year. And when I got to know more people with the disease, of course, I was already familiar with the disease when I worked on the neurology ward, but that was more with late stage patients. I just got attracted by the positivity of the people and the willing to find a cure of the disease. And that actually still drives me today to work together with the people and the colleagues in the field to hopefully, or potentially in the near future, that we try to find some cure.
I see. Yeah, you say the positivity of the people trying to find a cure. I think in ALS and similar diseases, it's very important that the researchers are really committed to doing it, because if you think about it, normally when a patient knows they have ALS, they know as of today, they won't have a cure before the disease is over, most probably. Because we know research takes a lot of time, and usually when we talk about finding a cure for something, we are talking about a time span of 10, 20, 30 years sometimes. I can see that for researchers and clinicians working on ALS, has to be really hard to work on a topic that you know the people you're dealing with, the patients you're dealing with, are not going to make it, and you're basically doing it for future patients. You're trying to basically find something that when one person one day finds out they have ALS, their doctor can tell them, but don't worry, we are going to put you on this treatment and you should be improving in span of 6-9 months. But even anything that could extend the lives of these patients will be a great breakthrough in this disease. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you meet with ALS patients, they become like philosophy teachers almost for all of us. And I think this is why for people working in the ALS field, it is a tough field. So either people will try it and find it not for them, either it will just stuck with people and people will remain in the field for a very long period of time. And it is because of that, of what you just explained, Pablo. It is very rewarding working alongside those patients, and they teach us a lot. So it's also this kind of, it goes both way, the relationship you have with patients. We are there to support them throughout mainly clinical trials, Tommy and I. This is a big part of our activity, but they bring a lot to us as well.
Sometimes I get questions by people that join a clinical trial, like how do we cope, not only myself, but also people in the team. And it's exactly that people with the disease and joining clinical trials ask that question. That only reflects how they are willing to collaborate with us in finding a cure for the disease, and also how that they have eye not only for themselves to find a treatment, but also for future patients and for their fellow patients. So I believe people that are joining clinical trials do it also for a large part, for altruistic part. And that, I think, that characterizes the patients with ALS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a real selflessness into the approach they have. And it makes you wonder when you receive a diagnosis that means that you have up until like 2 to 5 years left, making the conscious decision of dedicating part of this time to a clinical trial, meaning you will have to come for very long visits and several times a month or several times a year. It means a lot. And that's a huge factor. This altruistic factor Tommy was describing is a big part. Some other patients report that joining clinical trials is also for them a way to gain control, to gain it back, because ALS is something that takes things away from you. So you deciding to be part in a clinical trial is also a control game changer, which is also very interesting to hear when we discuss with patients, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So in ALS research, of course, like most medical research, it starts with animal models. And if I remember correctly, mouse mutants are usually the main research model. Are the SOD1 is one of the typical mutations on ALS. Are the SOD1 mutant mice still the main focus on this research, or are new animal models nowadays that reflect more closely how the disease progresses in humans and so on? So for those listening, before giving the word to you, the main problem that researchers had with SOD mutant mice is that for humans, the disease usually lasts 2 to 4 years. So when you have a patient on a clinical trial, you have this time to see the progression of the disease and the response to the treatment they are receiving. But in the other hand, these mice, when the mutation is active, they usually tend to have about a week or two before they die. Is that correct, or did it change over the last years of research?
So the SOD1 mutant mice model is still like a very preeminent model in ALS. Mice model in general are still the ones being used the most. Something to keep in mind is that, yes, the SOD1 mice model is very aggressive and interesting. However, it reflects like SOD1 pathology, and not all ALS patients are SOD1 ALS patients. So the vast majority of ALS patients are called sporadic ALS patients. So what it means is that we have no idea of the mechanism behind the disease. Why do they have ALS and not their neighbor? We can't explain it. So that's, I think, something to keep in mind when we talk about the SOD1 mice model, is that it does not reflect the majority of the ALS population.
Yeah.
So something we can add to that is I know a lot of organoid models are being developed more and more in labs. Actually, there's an amazing team led by Tom Durkin in Montreal that is developing those organoids and like mini brains in petri dishes that they are developing to later on use them as a platform to test drug for drug development. So other models are being developed, and all of this is also using stem cells from ALS patients that are being collected. So like a mixture between animal model and those stem cell-derived models will be the future in ALS.
Yeah.
That's still where we are.
That's a very interesting topic. So organoids are really interesting because it's basically extracting the part you're interested in. In this case, neurons. So you can do these mini brain organoids, which are basically like small structures made of 1, 2, or 3 cell types normally, that they grow in a small plate. And the advantage they have over animal models and the traditional research is that basically you can study lots of things at the same time, because you can grow as many organoids as you want. And even though they take a bit of time, brain organoids take about 2 months or so to reach the maturity stage. It makes them very valuable because basically, as you have the organoid growing on a plate, you can add anything to the media where these organoids are cultured, so the food that these organoids have, and you can see how they react to the treatments. So after doing the treatment, you can just grab the organoids. You don't need to kill any animal. You can just grab the tissue from there, from the plate. You can put it on a slide, and you can see through the microscope and through biochemical assays how the cells are reacting to the treatment.
Yeah, ethically, it's super, super interesting.
Yeah, I think at the point we are now, probably organoids and cells are the way to go into this. So I'm glad to hear that these new techniques are helping shaping the new ALS research in that way.
Yeah, definitely. And for the listeners interested in this, the Montreal team developing this, they are under an open science concept. So they are sharing all of their protocols in videos on their website, both in French, Spanish, and English, last time I checked.
So that's one of the ways to do research. What are you doing on your PhD, Julia? I think we haven't gone into the details of what you're doing for the disease.
Yeah, so my PhD is kind of a patchwork of different interests I have around ALS. So some of it is looking at cognition of ALS patients. That's a a big interest of mine. I did my master's in Alzheimer's, and I think that sticks with me since. For a long time, we thought ALS had nothing to do with cognition. And now, as research is progressing, we have realized that 50% of ALS patients either present with or will develop cognitive symptoms. So this is, for me, very interesting. And I'm looking at it through the apathy spectrum, so the lack of motivation, lack of initiation. And something I'm developing in my PhD is to see if ALS patients present with a certain level of apathy, how can this impact their will to participate in clinical trial? Because maybe there's a huge discrimination effect happening from the get-go as soon as you meet your patient. Because, of course, if you're very apathic, you don't have the will or motivation to be part in a trial. And even if you are at the beginning, maybe you will develop apathy as your disease progression go, and then you're more likely to drop out. So everything is kind of linking cognition, apathy, clinical trial access, clinical trial participation. And I'm tying this all up with looking at equity and access in clinical trials, and specifically how can we maximize chances for ALS patients to be considered when being pre-selected for clinical trial participation. And I'm based in Stockholm, as you said earlier, and we're very lucky in the Nordics that there's a lot of patient registries being developed. And so now I'm looking at how can we use the registries to pre-screen ALS patients, because those registries, they are national. So they include all the ALS patients from the country. So everybody can be considered. And ultimately, this would mean if you're an ALS patient from a very small town, lost in the north of Sweden, you have as much chances to be considered for a trial as if you're next to the biggest Swedish hospital. And that's, of course, applicable for all over as soon as you have registries. So it's a bit of a patchwork of all of those things.
I see. And on the other hand, you say, Tommy, you're more on the clinical side of the research and the disease. How does your work look like?
So my work looks like a combination of seeing patients and following them up into the clinical trials, and as well like being in the part of the development on the and training on the outcome measures. So it's basically setting up, executing, and leading the team that is working on the clinical trials, but also seeing the patients myself.
And do you also see, as Juliet said, their mental state when they go into the trials? You also work onto that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do see patients with broader spectrum of frontotemporal dementia, which is mainly a exclusion criteria for the majority of the clinical trials. We do have a couple of clinical trials that allow people with frontotemporal dementia, but that's based on their course of the mechanism of action of the study drug. So we have a clinical trial that's mainly focusing on the C9orf mutation, which is, besides the SOD1, a different mutation that appears on people with the disease, and that can also express not only in ALS, but also at ALS and frontotemporal dementia and frontotemporal dementia itself. What we saw on, we had a couple of people with frontotemporal dementia included in that trial. It brings another level of complexity. Not only, most of the time, people who have physical impairments will suffer from logistical aspects, so coming through their home into our clinic. But people who have frontotemporal dementia, they need extra explanations of what you're going to do, and you need to reassure that people are still conscious and willing to participate in the clinical trial.
Yeah, it's a very hard process. And I can imagine talking to the patients, assessing them, and then deciding how to proceed or not. It's hard probably for you and also for the patient himself, because they have to face this new reality they are in. On top of that, as you said, in many cases, ALS pairs with frontotemporal dementia, and they might not be in their best state to make an informed decision. So it's really hard for everybody working on that.
It's very difficult and it takes a lot of experience and expertise, because now when you have this frontotemporal dementia FTD diagnosis, either standing alone or alongside ALS, you have a diagnosis. What's really tricky is when you have an ALS diagnosis, you start noticing changes, but you don't have an FTD diagnosis yet. And then you're in kind of this gray zone where you have a feeling, but in the same time, maybe it's the personality of your patient, because you don't know your patient on a personal level. You haven't known them for 10 years before you've met them. So it's very difficult sometimes of thinking, oh, well, this person is a bit quirky. That's how they are. Or no, I'm really seeing a difference. The family members are reporting a difference to the study team. It's how do you learn to pick up on those small things? Like, this person was very reserved and now he wants to hug everybody when he meets them. So it's all of those little things that you learn to process and notice.
Yeah, and I think that it's a good point, Julia, that it's not only affecting the patients, the study team, but also the caregivers. And that's also important for study participation, that you also have a good eye for people that come with the patient through the clinical trial. So it can be a spouse, like a neighbor, a brother or sister, but it's important to discuss the progress of the trial and involving the caregiver as well.
Definitely. And then once you go into starting a trial with one of the patients, how are the treatments nowadays? How many treatments, or how do they work? What do you offer to them when they have the diagnosis?
So what we do similarly in Stockholm, here in Utrecht as well, is that we pre-screen our patients through the registries that we have. And like when I started in 2015, we had two or three clinical trials that was approached for the entire population, just oral medication. And as the field progressed, we can now offer a more tailored approach. So it is based on genetic mutation. So currently there are a couple of trials that target a certain genetic mutation. We currently have four in Utrecht, but there are several others across the globe. So it's that makes a different approach than just offering the entire an ALS patient all the clinical trials. It's more targeted.
100%. And also, so both Tommy and I are linked to TRICALS. Tommy even more, because he's our dear rater. So training everybody at the site so we can assess patients the same way. And so when you're part of TRICALS, you will notice that most TRICALS sites are doing the main international ALS clinical trials. So that's a continuity for the European, especially European ALS population as well. And we've seen a huge boom in terms of numbers of ALS trials. As you were saying, Tommy, a few years ago, it was 2 to 3 trials. And now we're dealing with 10 of them and a bit more with the upcoming trials. So there's really this notion that it's not a one-size-fits-all when it comes to ALS trials. So if you meet 5 ALS patients, you would not recommend the exact same trial to the 5 of them. It's really, where are you in your disease progression? What are the inclusion-exclusion criteria of each clinical trial? What makes most sense for you at that time? And what are your limitations? Like, this trial is going to be very demanding, but you're telling me you're not going to be able to come to all of those appointments. Well, maybe that does not make sense. Or you have a specific mutation, genetic mutation, and one trial is targeting this mutation specifically. Maybe that's the one that makes more sense for you right now. So it's really considering all of those aspects as well.
Regarding those treatments, as you mentioned before, ALS, the majority of the ALS cases are sporadic. So there is no familiar case before the patient, and it just presented for the first time on the patient, and only about 15% are genetic cases that have the cause in a mutation that is inherited from a family member. Are the trials for both cases the same? So the sporadic cases, now with all the detection of the mutations, probably this directed therapy can also be applied to sporadic ALS, right? Because in the past, when most of the mutations were really hard to reach, when you have a patient, if it's a genetic case, it's so much easier to apply a directed therapy because you know which mutations you're looking for. But now when you have a sporadic case, how is the diagnosis? How do you find the mutations and how do you decide to apply the therapy?
Yeah, so we do offer, and I think that's that's not only the case in Utrecht, but more a global approach that we offer genetic testing at the time of diagnosis. So for research, we do whole genome sequencing, but not always cycle the answer back to the, or the outcome back to the patients. However, we have a certain set of genes that are known that we offer to the patients to get them genotyped. And once there is a positive mutation, we then will recommend them to participate in that particular trial if there is a trial for that mutation that was found. And that's regardless whether it's sporadic or familial, as it could be a de novo mutation in that particular family. So it's, we don't make the approach like whether the case is familial or sporadic. We do it, we offer everyone to do genetic testing. So it's up to the patient if they want that or not, because that of course have implications for the family if the if a mutation was found.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And when it comes to applying this into treatment and clinical trials, then again, the line can be a bit blurry. And then it's not always as defined as sporadic versus genetic cases. I have in mind a clinical trial that is testing, it's an antibody targeting the misfolded SOD1 protein. So when you have the genetic mutation SOD1, your SOD1 protein is misfolded. It's not folded the right way. And for a long time, we thought misfolded SOD1 proteins were only found in SOD1 patients. However, recent research has shown that you can detect certain levels of misfolded SOD1 protein even in sporadic cases. So there's a currently drug under investigation that is actually including both SOD1 patients and sporadic patients because of this rationale behind it. So sometimes it's a bit more blurry than we might think.
Yeah, I see. I can imagine that with the cohort of patients that you have for ALS, this makes probably collaboration extremely important. And that's the reason that we are also going to talk about the networks, because if we consider only one country, let's say either the US or Sweden, especially for European countries, which are smaller and small population compared to the US, it's much more clear that in Sweden, for example, I can imagine the number of patients is around 100 countrywide.
It's a bit more. We have around 250 patients, but it's still, yes, a small number. Yeah.
I see. Yeah. So if you have 250 patients, and from those, not all of them are going to basically, are not going to qualify for a therapy, you're talking of a very small group of people to which you can apply a treatment. So collaborating within other European countries, with other hospitals, and a larger group of people probably makes the research advance much faster than if countries were working separately. So in research, we always have this dilemma between the collaboration versus the competition, because part of our work is publishing our results, and the money we get to do more research usually comes from the publications that we do. So how does it work with ALS? How can you collaborate and at the same time get all the benefits of getting the publications, getting the results, and being able to fund your research? How does this huge task of getting money to do your research and at the same time collaborate to advance as fast as possible work? How do you do it?
That's a great point. In every field, you will always find this handful of people who don't appreciate collaboration, but they are definitely a minority, I would say, in ALS. This is how Tommy and I met. This is a group of people that, I'm talking about the ALS community now, that I think very early on understood that if we were all staying in our little corners, we would never find a cure for ALS. So it kind of perhaps almost became a question of survival in the field, that you would not survive as a researcher if you don't collaborate. So this is how, like, NEALS in the US was born. This is how TRICALS was born. This is how now INARC, I think we're going to talk more about all of those networks later on, but it was a matter of survival at first, of like scientific survival, to find a cure for patients.
Yeah, and I think especially on the genetic part, like, ALS is a rare disease, but if you define it into the genetic mutations, it's ultra rare. And you're not going to progress in your research if you're just sitting around with your one or two patients with a certain mutation. You need to team up to get larger numbers.
Absolutely. And I think the genetic aspect is a great one that Tommy just made, because, for example, for the SOD1 profile, it's usually a very aggressive form of ALS. But us in Sweden, we usually see SOD1 patients with a slower disease progression. So it's a niche in a niche in a niche. So if you don't collaborate on this, you'll never find answers to your research questions.
Definitely. So the way many of these networks appeared is because you need to join efforts into finding this cure and organizing researchers, clinicians, and patients into these larger groups that can basically do some progress all together. If we talk about associations and networks of ALS, a quick search online brings a lot of names, and even both of you are part of several networks. So just to start a few names, you're both founders of the International Network for ALS Research. But there is also TRICALS, which is trying to find a cure through clinical trials, if I'm correct.
Exactly.
We also have the International Alliance of ALS Associations. We also have the Northeast ALS Consortium. What aspects of ALS research and clinical trials each of these cover, and how do they coordinate together? Because I'm pretty sure all of them they are all going through the same goal, to the same goal. So how do all these networks cooperate and collaborate together?
Yeah, to start off with TRICALS, I think it's important to, if companies offer clinical trials to you, that you're ready to execute the trial. And with being trial ready, or like having trial readiness, it's not only identifying your patients, but having sufficient staff, locations in the hospital, and people that are trained to perform the clinical trials in the same way. And I think that's a perfect example what TRICALS bring together. It's like, if a company from the US will come to Europe to execute a trial, they have to go through a number of trials. As you said, in Europe, we are having significant smaller countries. And with TRICALS, we try to be acting as one Europe to speed the process up. What we try to do as INARC is, and Juliet, add on, please, is to bring the research coordinators, study nurses, so the people that work in clinical trials and care, exchange experience just to improve the research and care for the patients, so for people actually that are on the floor. That can be from a saliva treatment in care, or it can be how is your unit organized if you talk on clinical trials.
No, absolutely. It's really what sparked our will and motivation to build the network, so INARC. And one of our main goals was to bring those people together, so study nurses, study coordinators, physiotherapists, OTs, speech language therapist working in a clinic and or in clinical trials, to have them have a voice at the table. Because usually at all of those other networks that we are part of, those discussions are led by physicians, and they also usually lead research. They're also researchers. But the people meeting on a day-to-day basis are ALS patients, both in clinic and in trials. They are not physicians, and we wanted them to have a platform to network exchange expertise and experience? How do we learn from this? What do we learn from this? Is this something that is applicable to my site or to your site? We were amazed at the differences we are observing within one country. So can you imagine the kind of things we can learn from each other when you talk country to country? So that's really what sparked the idea of Inark, and we started working really on it February 2022 at our first network around NCAL, so the European network for ALS, where we meet every summer for a conference. We had our first Inark workshop there. We officially launched it at another meeting in San Diego in November. And so now we are preparing for NCALS 2023 that will be in Barcelona. So that's kind of the global view on this.
Okay, that seems like a lot of work. So let's go a bit more into the international network that you both founded, because I think basically you can give us a firsthand experience on how this works. So coordinating those many people, organizing conferences, bringing everyone together to try to both educate, share the research, and collaborate all with each other. That's a lot of work. How is the association, how is the organization funded, coordinated, and managed? It's all extra work on your shoulders, right?
It's not something Tommy and I are employed to do. It is definitely something that we do out of passion. We are also, Tommy and I, both very lucky to have supervisors who are both TRICALS board member and who are very supportive of the kind of endeavors we are doing. And as you mentioned, we co-founded the network, but we did not co-found it alone. We are surrounded by the most amazing team of people coming from the Netherlands, Canada, Sweden, and much more, especially in Europe. And now we are developing the network. We have members coming from Colombia as well, and soon Asia, we hope, and next Africa. So this is definitely a team's effort.
Yeah, and as we started, like, our patients are very positive and like willing to participate on clinical trials, even though they have a short life expectancy. So it's also motivates us, and it's not only me and Juliet, of course. It's also the other team members, just to give that little bit of extra. Like, if that will help to organize the clinical trials and the care better around ALS patients, we are happy just to deliver that little bit of extra work.
I see. You're also organizing a conference in Barcelona. You said it's the next meeting. How does it work organizing this? I know it's probably a huge team effort. And how does the organization work to do that? And how does it look like when you go all together to a place and share all this research?
Well, it's a lot of nerds all together talking about ALS, that's for sure. And so the conference itself is the NCALS conference. And so what we are doing is that we are dedicating one full day before the conference really starts to what we call a satellite meeting. That will be an INARC satellite meeting. And how it works is that Tommy and I, having co-founded with others the network, we are part of the organizing committee. And so each year for conferences, we appoint a meeting committee. So this year we have an NCALS, INARC meeting committee that is composed of people from Italy, from Spain, from Switzerland, from the UK, so and more countries, Colombia. And so this meeting committee is appointed by us, the organizing committee, and we meet every 2 to 3 weeks. And of course, this is virtual because we all live around the world. So usually, like if we go into the nitty-gritty of it, people will start to get familiar with each other, with everybody's background. And then we exchange on last year's conference, and we really wanted to start from what do you want as a meeting committee? What will serve you? Because we don't want then the attendees of our day to sit there and feel like they've learned nothing. We want them to be able to take something from the day we'll create for them. And who's better place for this than the meeting committee? So this is really what started our conversation and discussions. What do you want to learn? So we brainstormed on this, and this is not easy doing it virtually with people who sometimes I've never met. And almost none of us are native speakers in English. So it's always very funny with all of this, but we make it work. And so, for example, for this year, themes that emerge for the conference will be like palliative care and spiritual care in ALS, both for patients and for team staffs. And it really sprouted from very organic conversations we've had, I would say, Tommy.
Yeah, and I think that also engaged people that are in the fields to be part of the network, because it's we're organizing it, of course, for people working with ALS, but it's driven by topics that are currently on people's mind that then can be discussed in a broad audience.
Definitely, those conferences are basically a labor of love, because it's a lot of work on top of all the work that you already have, a lot of coordination with other people around the globe to bring everyone together. And everyone going there is very willing to learn, because you go for that reason, for that same reason you go to exchange ideas, to exchange your knowledge. And then you all go with a very open-minded to what the others are going to present. And that's the pinnacle in the end of this kind of collaboration we've been talking about, because that's the place where most ideas can be exchanged in real time with a lot of people together. And from there, I'm sure like new research lines start, or new clinical trials can be developed, and new connections with other researchers, other clinicians and psychologists and so on can be started. I'm sure it's extremely exciting, not only to organize it and have all this work, but also going there and being able to talk to all these people.
It's an amazing experience, and it's like on every level, personal, professional, and it's very humbling, learning from everybody else. And everybody has a different reality. Sometimes they're working in very small facilities. Sometimes they're part of huge hospitals. And it's an amazing reality check, I would say, on many levels.
So now I wanted to jump a bit more into the details of the clinical trials. I mean, we're not going to go deep into all the stages of a clinical trial and so on, but there is a point that I think it's really interesting for ALS, and is the fact that with all this collaboration and all these new lines of research, compared to, for example, like 10, 15, 20 years ago, now patients face a lot of choices. So when you get a new patient, and they will probably qualify for not one, but several clinical trials. How is that both coordinated, explained to the patient, and then how do they choose which of these trials is going to be the one they register to?
Yeah, so it's a process for patients to, because they first need to process their diagnosis. So not every patient is open to participating or hearing about clinical trials right after their diagnosis. However, we start that conversation after 2 weeks. We follow up with people after them hearing that they have the disease. For some of them, it's like just a confirmation from other hospitals. For some of them, it's the first time that they hear about the disease. But we want to provide the option to everyone that's recently being diagnosed. And then not for everyone, it's known what their genetic mutation is after these 2 weeks. So we pre-check based on their clinical characteristics, which clinical trial they qualify, and then offer them a selection. But as you said, this selection can be like 4 to 5 clinical trials. We discuss with them the intensity of the trial. Do they need to come to the hospital like every week, or is it every 3 months? The mechanism of action, we discuss with them, and what potentially can gain from it. And what I mean by that is, like, is there an open label extension? So do they have access to the actual study medication? We do not then know whether it helps them or not, but at least we can just offer them something back. And also the phase of the clinical trial. So whether it's a phase 1, 2, or 3 trial.
Yeah. I think that's that draws a very clear picture. It's a lot of discussion and it's a lot of team discussion, and it does not happen in one sitting. This is something that, as Tommy mentioned, is followed up on. Like, it takes weeks and it takes dedicated staff. It takes phone calls. It takes giving like consent forms to review, and then you have to have a study member who will dedicate time to call the patient, answer questions, call family members, answer their questions. And you can schedule several meetings with the neurologist just to discuss those topics. So it's really like a big team effort on supporting the patient in their choice.
And in the case of ALS, when you inform the patient about the clinical trials, you need to be very frank with them. And they have to know that even though they are going to receive an experimental treatment, those treatments in most cases are not going to, that the treatment is not going to cure them. Mm-hmm. So I think from the patient choice is a very honorable and a very hard decision to make. And it speaks very fond of them, because mm-hmm. on top of facing the fact that they have just a few years left, they also have to make a decision on starting a treatment that they know most probably is not going to be for them, but for generations to come after them. And that speaks very highly of those patients, both mentally and about their heart and their passion to try to help others in the situation that they've been given in life. And I can imagine, as a clinician, it has to be, on one hand, very hard to deal with this day to day, but on the other hand, it has to feel very gratifying to see people so committed to helping others, right?
Yeah, definitely. And just to reflect a little bit, like, on people that get on board or choose to be part of a clinical trial, it's also hope. And as Juliet said, like, it's also gaining control about their life, as they only losing things during that 3 to 5 year period after the symptom onset. So I think it's very important to reiterate that we all, as clinicians, of course, know it potentially might slow down the disease. We do not know yet. There are many uncertainties, but we always have hope for that particular patient joining the clinical trial, that it will extend, or maybe their quality of life will remain stable for a certain amount of period that they are in the clinical trial. So it's therefore, yes, we need to be frank, but also we want to provide people with hope that are going to be on the clinical trial. And we therefore also zoom out to look at the bigger picture. Why are we doing this? Of course, we are there on a day-to-day basis, but sometimes it's good to just sit back and think about, okay, where were we 8 to 10 years ago? That would not have happened without all these numbers of people participating, not only in like the interventional trials, but also the observational trials. So the MRI studies that we do, people that gave their blood for future research or went through questionnaires that we bored them with, that all adds to where we are today.
Definitely. It is very interesting to see it from an outsider view, how it works with the disease. And I'm pretty sure a big help to all of this working, it's not only the collaboration between the researchers and clinicians, but also all these patients and all the people that it's involved into getting others to know about the disease, because that's going to bring the general interest into it and also try to help bring more awareness to the organisms that are in charge of funding all these trials, of collaborating with all these trials, all the pharmaceutical companies that are developing new compounds that could be used for the disease. And in that sense, as important as collaboration in ALS, probably the advocacy and the involvement in making everyone understanding how it works and what it happens is also very important. And I'm pretty sure patients also have a big role on that.
They have the biggest role in advocacy, and this is a big challenge we have in ALS in many aspects, where first of all we're considered to be a rare diseases, part of like the domain of rare diseases, but ALS is one of the least rare of the rare diseases, but still funded like a rare disease. So that is definitely challenging. And then on the other hand, you have patients who are so involved in being strong ALS advocates, but you have to also put this into perspective with, let's say, cancer patient advocacy, where you can live an entire life with cancer. You can live 20 years with cancer. You live 2 to 5 years with ALS. So, of course, you do not have the same energy levels to put into advocacy groups, advocacy networks, doing fundraising, having a Facebook page. Like all of those things, it takes time, energy, resources that ALS patients, most of them, they don't have it. So how do you then, from there, this is our reality, how do you then build onto this? And it usually comes to amazing individuals finding each other, making it work, using their network, and being supported by the scientific community. And that's where it's quite exceptional when all of those things align to see it happen.
Definitely. For that, there are also networks of patient associations, if I'm correct. These associations also help informing new patients about the trials, their options, and how to proceed from there. Apart from, of course, connecting patients with each other, because that probably, and as you're working also, Juliet, on the mental part of the disease, that probably helps a lot the patients when they're faced with a new reality. Having other people that are going through the same probably helps them rationalize their disease and be more prepared for what it's coming and what options they have. How do you connect them with this kind of association? How do you help them find these people?
So I think we, like Tommy and I are a good example because we have very different realities. In Sweden, it doesn't exist like a specific ALS association led by or for ALS patients. We have other associations, other networks, but there's definitely a gap currently in Sweden. So it is really like resources do exist. They are not ALS specific, and you need to have a study team that is informed and that will then relay information to you. I'll let Tommy describe his reality that is very different because the landscape in the Netherlands is quite exceptional in that way. But an example on a larger scale would be ALS Canada. That is a huge association then divided into provinces. And so you have ALS Quebec, ALS Ontario, and so on. So when you are diagnosed in Canada, you are put usually by your clinic in touch with the ALS Association of your province. And then those people take over, like putting you in touch with all of the funding resources, network people you may need to, for example, access, like how do you get access to a wheelchair and all of those things. So they are really there to support you. And Tommy can shed some light on the landscape in the Netherlands.
Yeah, so in the Netherlands, we do have a quite active patient association. And yeah, what we do after people are being diagnosed, they will get a binder with all kinds of information, like also for mental support, but also like a flyer on our clinical trial website where all the trials are outlined and briefly summarized, and also the flyer or the contact details for the patient association. And we also have a fundraising group that organizes events to collect not only awareness, but of course also funds to continue our research. And there doing activities such as cycling on the Mont Ventoux or city swims. So we swim in the canals of Amsterdam, they're organizing walks. But I think it's also important for people with the disease to make the policy makers aware of the disease, but also, like, currently we're doing a lot of clinical trials, but if a clinical trial is proven effectively, to get it as soon as possible to the patients.
Yeah. On to that, the advocacy is not only important for helping the patients, but also helping everyone related to the disease. And if the listeners remember, a few years ago, I mean, if about 10 years ago, you ask anyone on the streets about ALS, most people won't be able to tell you what it is and what exactly the disease causes. Everyone knows about cancer. Everyone knows about the big disorders such as Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. But ALS and other slightly more rare diseases are big unknowns in the population. But thanks to the coordination of these associations and this advocacy, a few years ago, probably everyone remembers the Ice Bucket Challenge. And that was a really big, bold move. And I think it helped a lot to bring awareness about the disease because everyone saw the videos. And even though it's a funny viral thing to see, and like, oh, look at all these people, all these famous people just throwing a bucket of ice over their heads, it really helped making everyone realize there is this disease. It needs money to do the research. It needs awareness of everyone. And if I'm not mistaken, it helped a lot raising funds for ALS research globally, right?
Yes, that's definitely correct. So not only funds, but also I remembered I started my job in 2015 in ALS. And when I said, like, oh, I started to work on ALS, and that was just the period that the Ice Bucket Challenge was. Oh, you're going to work with the disease that the Ice Bucket Challenge was organizing for. So that was also interesting to hear back from people that are not familiar with the disease, that they linked it, that particular event. That hugely contributed to awareness and funds indeed.
And that did a lot to also bring people who had a large audience. And I would say when such a thing is personalized, it has a huge impact socially. So seeing Bill Gates doing the Ice Bucket Challenge brought a lot. And this is something you notice in science, thinking of neurological diseases. For example, Michael J. Fox and the Michael J. Fox Foundation has done a lot for Parkinson. And you, like, of course, Stephen Hawking has been the face of ALS for a long time. And recently we had the passing of Börje Salming, who was extremely famous in the hockey world, both in Canada, Sweden. So as soon as you personalize the disease, I think it has a huge effect on the population as well. And this has repercussions when it comes to patient advocacy and collecting funding for it.
Definitely, definitely. It sounds superficial and silly, but humanizing, bringing other feelings of something that can be really funny to see, but at the same time, it's kind of impacting, as you said, important. Seeing very important people suddenly do the Ice Bucket Challenge will make those that had no idea about it hear about it, see the videos and say, oh, what are they fighting for? And it will bring a lot of people on board. And usually those are the things that make policymakers realize, oh, maybe we should help fund this research. Even if it's just to appease or make their voters happy, it helps a lot to see this kind of movements.
100%.
And they are definitely on the shoulders of those that know the disease and have to live with it. So it's very important, this advocacy. And it helps a lot into bringing hope and joining everyone together into the proper steps.
Absolutely.
And so one last thing I wanted to touch on. We've been seeing all this joint effort into advancing the disease, but we still know that the diagnosis is bad and it's heartbreaking. Is there any hope in the near future, something really new that it's coming into the field that makes us think things can be reaching a turning point into ALS?
There's several. Earlier, Tommy and I were saying there's no one-size-fits-all clinical trial. Well, it's the same for treatment. And now, more and more, you hear that ALS should be actually described as a syndrome and not as one disease. So all of this is leading us to think that certain types of ALS will become treatable before other types of ALS. And for a long time, we've put ALS in the same bucket, and we realize it's more complex than that. And so, for example, something that has been heavily now described in the literature, and more papers are coming out around it, and clinical trials are being developed and being run for a few years now, is the example of what we call the tofersen trial, which is the example of an antisense oligonucleotide drug, so ASO, and that is specifically designed for SOD1 patients. And so as those types of drugs are coming up and being developed, it is leading us to think that genetic cases or specific cases of ALS will become treatable that way. So the ASO is like, of course, like mechanistically super interesting because it's like intrinsically delivered, and then it targets directly not your misfolded protein in the end, but much more upward. So I would say those types of targets will probably be some of the first like unlocks of the disease. I don't know what you think, Tommy.
Yeah, fully agree, Juliet. So it's indeed like currently we have the success of SOD1, and we are working on like similar type of drugs on the FAS mutation, on the ataxin-2 mutation, and there is also a general antisense that try to work on TDP-43, which is a protein more broader defects in the ALS patients. So I think indeed like that's the way where we find these treatments first effective and will come available, of course, to a smaller group, but it will be, although even small, it will be a success. And I think for the other patients or for patients without a genetic mutation, that there will be a combination of several therapies. So that will be therapies. If you look at them individually, they maybe have a smaller effect. But if you add them on, four or five different therapies, that in total will have a larger effect. And with the number of clinical trials currently ongoing, I hope we just approach or achieve that step in the near future. But I think the ASOs will come first.
But what you just described to me is really what is approaching, which is personalized medicine for ALS patients. And so as you will meet a patient, you will do a battery of tests. You will learn a battery of information coming from biomarkers, genetic history, and all of this. And from this, the goal is to be able to then make a tailor-made approach for that patient. That's really what we are leaning toward now.
Therefore, it's also important that patients not only participate in clinical trials, but also in observational studies that will give us more information on the disease as a syndrome, as Juliet just described, how everyone progresses over time and which are proper biomarkers, because currently the primary outcome measure in the majority of trials is a questionnaire, and that could be improved as well and might result in more positive clinical trials.
From my viewpoint, it really seems like the disease is now entering like an exponential growth of trials, knowledge, and that's usually very, very positive, because that means there are more people working on it, there are more people aware of it, there will be way more development on the disease, and especially with the new personalized therapies, that's probably going to help find a way to be able to treat such a heterogeneous disease that it's caused by so many mutations that end up basically in the same outcome, but they are all, you need to consider every patient different, because the mutations that some patients have are totally different from others. So this personalized medicine brings a lot of hope into a field that until now, it's been feeling very stalled and like very slowly progressing, and suddenly it feels like it's going ahead at full speed, and hopefully in the progress of this decade we can see a big change in the field and in the prognosis for these patients.
Yeah, this is what we tell our interns. We always tell them, this is now. You want to be with us now. You want to work on ALS right now, because things are moving very quickly.
That is extremely exciting and probably makes your job way more rewarding than it was 20 years ago. So it's a great time to work on this. And I'm very happy that people like you are working on this, because those are the ones that are moving it forward. So a big thank you for that to both of you and everyone that works on ALS.
Thank you, Pablo.
Okay, so with that, I really want to thank both of you, not only for working on this, but also for joining me today to speak about it and make more people aware of the disease and how is it going. It's really been extremely informative. And I also hope that our listeners also found it interesting and very educating. So if people want to know more about ALS, where can they find you and where can they go?
So for our team in Stockholm, if you go into Google and you type ALS Karolinska unit, you will find the team I'm working with, led by the amazing Caroline Inge in Stockholm at the Karolinska University Hospital and Karolinska Institute. We are currently building the ENaC network page, so coming up very soon. And I would suggest looking at the TRICALS website as well. And we are quite active on LinkedIn as well with our names.
Yeah, I think TRICALS.org, both of our centers, like, and together with all the other centers in Europe, they can find us, our teams, and also the research that the clinical trials that we're currently conducting in our trials.
Everything is listed there.
Great. I'll also add some links to the show notes, so people can also check the notes of the podcast to see them. Thank you again. It's been really a pleasure. And thanks for all your work, and keep it up. It sounds very promising.
Thank you so much, Pablo, for having us today.
Thank you. And thank you for giving us the opportunity to spread the word about ALS.
Thanks a lot. And last but not least, I also want to thank you for listening. And if you like these stories and the others we have in our podcast, you can also find articles that we write on science and culture at culturico.com. You can find us on Twitter at culturico, and you can find me as iPabloSB. Although, since the latest events on Twitter, I'm not very active there. You will probably have better luck finding me on Mastodon as iPabloSB at quoto.org. And of course, if you like what we do, please let us know by leaving us a review on your podcast player. Feel free to spread the word. That really makes a lot. And thank you, and until next time.